protecting and enjoying Maine's brilliant night sky. Compared to the rest of the East Coast, Maine has low levels of light pollution, and the state has become a prime destination to appreciate dark skies as interest in astrotourism is growing. Two Maine places have recently earned special status from the International Dark Sky Association. Katahdin Woods and Waters is an official dark skies sanctuary, and Maine's 100-mile wilderness, an international dark skies park. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss why dark skies matter, and not just to astronomers. And we'll discuss ways that Maine communities can think differently about outdoor lighting so that people and animals can be healthier and more in tune with the skies. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine is one of the few places on the East Coast with large areas of unfettered by light pollution. That is why we are known as a dark sky destination. Today we're going to learn about the dark sky movement, why it matters, and where you can go to get a great view of the night sky. Joining me for today's program, Susan Arnold, who is Vice President for Conservation with the Appalachian Mountain Club, Sean Lotch, Director of the Versant Power Astronomy Center at the University of Maine. He is also Treasurer of Dark Sky Maine, and John Meter, Director of the Northern Stars Planetarium and Educational Services and Vice President and Secretary of Dark Sky Maine. We invite your questions and comments. Share your stories, your experiences with the dark skies. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to you all. And Sean, why don't we start with a little history about dark skies and the whole sense of how far we need to go back to a time when widespread light pollution was not part of the everyday experience for most humans, that most humans saw a spectacular night sky.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that sort of binds all humans together is in the past, before there were, gas and electric lights, we used to have very dark skies, and people spent a lot of time looking at the night sky, creating constellations that they used to navigate, to tell time, to know when to plant and harvest their crops. So they were very connected to the sky in so many different ways. But with the Industrial Revolution and, starting off with gas lights and then going to electric lights, people started adding more and more lights. And as that happened, particularly in city areas, of course, the sky started to slowly disappear, and now it's becoming a very rare thing. And so there's, of course, it's a major issue. And one of the big things, of course, is a lot of this light just goes upward, and really the energy is wasted, the resources are wasted, and it just lights up the sky, which doesn't really help much. So, but yeah, it's been, basically since the Industrial Revolution that we've continued to add more and more light. And people, especially in the modern age, I think, have this sense that light equals safety. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Most crimes actually happen at night, not during the daytime. But that's been another driver of things, at least in recent times, in the last probably 20 or 30 years in particular.
John, when did the dark sky movement begin to take hold, and what prompted it?
Well, here in Maine, I think it really got a good hold with the formation of Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. Back in 2013, a group of people, Nancy Hathaway and Lucas St. Clair and a few people, were looking at trying to create this national monument, and they realized the skies were just incredible there. So they got talking about creating an event in the area, which became Stars Over Katahdin, which is a yearly star party that happens around the fall equinox and the new moon. And it really started with that and bringing the public into the backwoods of Maine to look at the night sky. And that just kept growing. And then with the designation of the area as a national monument, and then a year ago, we got designated as a as an international dark sky sanctuary. It really started to grow. Then the AMC came along and we're doing the same thing with their properties. And we also have a group in Rangeley who's working towards the same thing in that region. So it really is spreading across the state in a really powerful way.
Susan, even before that, though, people were becoming increasingly aware of light pollution, correct? And the problems that light pollution causes. Can you talk about some of those? What happens both for humans and for animals when there's too much illumination at night?
Sure, yeah. With too much illumination, it obviously is impacting the sort of natural rhythms of day and night, and it can be confusing to migrating birds. I think people have heard a lot recently about the loss of birds. It also affects just the nocturnal animals who are using the night to feed, to move from place to place. And it's a part of the natural ecosystem. So in the same way AMC is involved in, you know, we're trying to protect forest land and watersheds and all protecting the dark night sky is really a part of that overall conservation of the natural world that's so important. And as was mentioned earlier, people used to be so connected to the night sky, and it also informed people's rhythms. And we've become very disconnected from that as well. And when you come to a place like AMC's International Dark Sky Park, you now will have the opportunity, I think, to reconnect and perhaps re-envision what it was like millions of years ago when the sky was as dark and as bright as it can be in Maine. And I do just have to add that we're exceptionally lucky in Maine to have what is really the last dark sky east of the Mississippi. If you look at a satellite photograph of the East Coast, sort of a megalopolis, but up in Maine, there's this black hole. It's very, very striking. And that black hole is Maine's North Woods. And that's where Katahdin Woods and Waters is. That's where AMC's International Dark Sky Park is. It's where Rangeley, you know, so we are in a very, very special place. And it didn't just happen. I guess that's the other final point I'll make, is that for decades, conservation organizations in Maine and beyond have been working to protect parts of the Maine North Woods, public land conservation through the state of Maine, through federal government. So there has been a very historic and concerted effort to protect this special place. And it also means at the same time, we have protected this incredible night sky.
So just to be clear, right now, and this is new as in the past year, that both Katahdin Woods and Waters and the 100 Mile Wilderness, AMC's portion of it, have had special designations. Katahdin Woods and Waters, Night Sky Sanctuary in the 100 Mile Wilderness, a Dark Sky Sanctuary. And AMC has a dark sky park, but these are areas that are designated as special. This is where you can see the sky in a way that you can't see it anywhere else on the East Coast. And Sean, I want to ask you, compared, say, somebody lives in Bangor or Portland or even farther south in Boston or Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and goes to one of these areas and looks up, what will one be able to see? What kind of what stars will they be able to see? What constellations that they can't see most nights in their urban area?
Sure. I think it is one of those areas that, depending on where you are, really impacts your view of the sky. If you're in a place like Boston or New York, you're lucky if you can see a handful, 5, 6, maybe 10 of the brightest stars. And maybe a few of the brightest planets like Venus or Jupiter. But when you know, if you're in an area, you know, Portland, of course, is better. It doesn't have quite as many lights, so you see a little bit more. Bangor is even better yet because you have less, there. So you're able to see a few things. But getting out to these really dark places are where you're going to be able to see the Milky Way, where you actually can see that, that hazy band, which is our galaxy, and really see it in all its glory. And you're going to see constellations where you can actually, you know, see all of the stars in the constellations, not just a couple of the brighter stars. So you're really going to have an incredible view of things getting out to these dark sky locations, particularly if it's a moonless night. You're going to be amazed at what you can see. I've had people who have been out in, you know, in dark sky areas with me from the city who have never been, and they're just amazed. They're like, where did all the stars come from? It's like, well, they're actually always there. It's just that you have too many lights up in your neighborhood or in your own backyard to see them, but you know, they're always there. And that's one of those things. I've taken groups to dark sky locations over my career, and they're always amazed at what, you know, what they see. And I think it's also a spiritual connection back to, again, like I say, humans have used these things. They were so used to them. And today we're often disconnected. But yeah, I mean, really, you're getting the full view of the sky, what the sky should look like from any place that, you know, but again, you do have to get to these very special places to really get it to be that dark.
Well, let me ask you this, Sean. We call it the dark sky movement, but if you're having this experience, if you're out in one of these wilderness locations and it's a moonless night, but the stars are everywhere, does it feel dark?
Yeah, I mean, it will feel dark in the sense that, you know, that you're going to have starlight, which is incredible, but it's going to be much darker than most people are used to, you know, because most people are used to having a certain level of light, especially if they live in a town or city. They're used to having street lights up. So they're used to having it be sort of bright and not really seeing much of the sky or just a few things in the sky, you know? So, but yeah, you will have, you know, if you're in a really dark sky location, there's been times where you can actually see a shadow by the Milky Way, from the Milky Way, your own shadow in that. You can definitely see that with moonlight. Of course, moonlight will create a shadow if there's not any other lights around you as well. But if it's dark enough, the Milky Way will do that too, which is really incredible. And it really is a mystical experience in many ways.
John, go ahead.
Yeah, I just say I do a lot of star parties with school kids because that's my focus. And we take them out. Sometimes it's just out behind their school at night. And they always want to come with flashlights and everything. Shut your flashlights off. They go, we will fall down. It's like, no, you won't. Shut them off. Just slow down for a few minutes. And they're amazed that within 20 minutes, they can see each other. They can actually identify each other in the pitch dark because our eyes do really well at adapting to that darkness. It takes our eyes, you know, for us adults, a good half hour to really fully dark adapt. Kids are a little quicker, of course, because they're younger bodies and younger eyes and that sort of thing. But they're always amazed how well they can see. And that translates into seeing fainter and fainter stars and more detail when you look at the Milky Way, for example, from a really dark spot. I was observing a few years ago and with a group of astronomy people, and someone said, who's got the flashlight on? Who's got the flashlight on? And we all looked around and no one had the flashlight on. It was under the late summer Milky Way, and we were actually seeing our shadows from the Milky Way, like Sean was suggesting. And we all just started laughing. It's like, wow, this is incredible.
Sean, I want to ask you, since you say you take younger kids out into these adventures, is there a great age, a sweet spot to take kids for the first time into their dark skies experience? What would you recommend to parents?
Oh, I take them out as soon as they're willing to go out. Though I'll tell you, I often do like 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th graders for the star parties. And almost always we'll have a group of, you know, 30 kids and they're all having fun. Some are fooling around a little more, but there's always one or two who just like get lost in it. They just totally get engrossed by it. And they want to know how the telescope works. And I give them I always have a couple small telescopes they can experiment with. And they're like, oh, I think I found Jupiter. And they get so excited. And it's so fun to see that enthusiasm with them discovering the sky, you know, and doing it on their own with little guidance.
Susan, I want to ask you about a term that I just learned. Even though we have done programs before on the dark sky movement, I have never before heard the term astrotourism or astrotourist. Tell me what that is and what you believe the potential is for astrotourism in Maine.
Well, astrotourism is tourist people who are specifically looking for those destinations that are going to provide them that experience of dark skies, or I think probably the example most people are familiar with is when there's a solar eclipse. You know, hundreds of thousands of people around the world travel to where the eclipse is going to be fully visible. And in fact, we have one coming to Maine in 2024, which is pretty exciting. But so that's astrotourism. That's, you know, people who are very focused on seeing the night sky, seeing particular constellations or planets when, you know, as you know, there's a lot of cyclical change in the sky. So it's an ongoing thing. I think the potential in Maine, you know, is, as it has been pointed out, there's multiple spaces now getting these kinds of designations from KWW to AMC, Rangeley Lakes, and increasingly communities like the community of Greenville, which is close to AMC's lands. They are looking at their lighting ordinances, making some changes in preparation for becoming what's known as a dark sky community, which will be another way of sort of underscoring that this is a destination, this is a place that values and honors the night sky. Come and, you know, come and see it with us. So I think there's huge potential in Maine, given once again, as I said at the outset, that we are the black hole on the East Coast. We're the place where you can see this.
Well, it's interesting to me because I know that currently the number one hobby in the U.S. in terms of the number of people who participate in some way is bird watching. Do you see, you all are nodding, Susan, do you see astrotourism or sky watching growing in popularity and rivaling bird watching?
I'll be interested in what other folks think. I mean, I'm not sure about the scale. I know that the bird watching has been huge, but yeah, I mean, it's a very compatible kind of activity. And in fact, there also are night birds. So you might even be able to combine the two.
John.
Yeah, and the thing I've noted, you know, I suggest to people, if they're birders, they have binoculars or spotting scopes. Point them at the night skies. People think, oh, you need a telescope. Binoculars are two little telescopes strapped together, and you'll see incredible things with your binoculars. It takes you quite a bit deeper, not as deep as a big telescope, but you can see so many cool things in the night sky with just your birding binoculars.
And so much easier to learn right now with the kind of like apps and things like that, that you might be able to not have to learn how to read a complicated book or a complicated manual to understand the night sky.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of people did pick up stargazing as an additional hobby because it was something that could get them outside, you know, which I think is really good too. I think oftentimes, you know, we are inside at night and, you know, a lot of people are in front of the, what I call the brain rotting device, otherwise known as the TV set, you know, and they spend so
much
time.
It's not brain rotting if they're watching PBS, but go on.
Well, no, but no, but a lot of times they're not watching that. You know, they're watching other stuff. So, but I mean, you know, I think in general, people spend too much time in front of screens. So if you can get them out into the real sky, it definitely helps and gives them something to see. And I would echo kind of what John said too about with students. I know we see a lot of students here at the planetarium, and it is one of those things that, you know, young kids really get into it. And initially, sometimes they are a bit afraid of the dark because they haven't been exposed to it. But once you can get them to see that it's really neat, it's amazing how if they see Jupiter or Saturn for the first time, how they want to do it again and again. And that's something really exciting for them.
Well, we are talking about the dark sky movement and particularly its impact here in Maine and also how the rest of us might learn more about the sky and benefit from dark skies in our community. We do need to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a minute. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Freeman Ellis Family Fund, supporting Maine Public Radio, local, national, and international news you can trust. And A Family for Me, a sperm wing program committed to raising awareness of the need for foster and adoptive parents. Learn more at afamilyformemaine.org.
When I say farmer, what do you see? Chances are you imagine an older white man staring off into middle distance in an Iowa cornfield, but farming is as diverse as the country itself. And we'll talk about what farming really looks like and what farmers really need. All that and more next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX.
Listen in. That's tonight at 8, right here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public News Connect is a new initiative developed to provide the top stories from Maine Public News in translation, thanks to the tremendous support of the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition, Umjambo Africa, and other community partners. Maine Public News Connect releases new video reports every Friday afternoon by 3 o'clock. Our pilot program includes news translated into French, Spanish, Portuguese, and Somali. You can find Maine Public News Connect reports online at mainepublic.org and on our social media platforms today at 3 p.m.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are learning about light pollution and the dark skies movement. My guest, Sean Lotch, who is director of UMaine's Versant Power Astronomy Center. John Meter, director of the Northern Stars Planetarium and organizer of Stars Over Katahdin. He is also a photographer. And Susan Arnold, the Appalachian Mountain Club's vice president for conservation. Share your comments or questions via email at talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now is Marlon. He is a performer and author of a new book on astrotourism and was involved with the dark sky movement starting in the 80s. And Marlon, I understand you're calling from Hawaii. Is that a pretty good place to view the stars?
It certainly can be. It was raining last night, but yes, there's a lot of great stargazing here.
So tell us how you got involved with the dark sky movement so long ago.
I was working in Las Vegas and L.A., and in between the two spaces is a grand desert there, and I went out to see Halley's Comet. And when I saw all of the stars overhead, I had the thought, my God, this goes by unnoticed every night because people's lights are on. Not long after that, I completely dropped out of show business and society, moved to the Big Island of Hawaii, and I lived in a treehouse for 5 years with no electricity, and became very conscious of the rhythm of the night and how a couple of nights, a couple of weeks every month, it was so bright from the moon, you didn't need any kind of a flashlight to move around. On the lava flow one night, I had an epiphany about all light being drawn to light and how the whole world would want to see a show about that, and that I was going to go back into show business. So for 21 years, I toured a production called LUMA, Art and Darkness and Theater of Light, to five different continents, and the show was done entirely in the dark on a stage with unseen performers manipulating illuminated objects to bring awareness to the loss of our night skies due to light pollution.
So you must be really excited to see so many new places being designated as either dark sky parks or sanctuaries, and the growing awareness and excitement about them.
I was thrilled by it, and it's what it's inspired me to write the book, Astrotourism, Stargazers, Eclipse Chasers, and the Dark Sky Movement. Because the way that I see it, we are not necessarily driven by the higher natures of our angels, but by our purses. And once the dark sky is seen as a resource that can be capitalized and monetized, people are going to be more inclined to protect it. I've done a couple of talks now for the Nebraska Tourism Board to help them bring dark sky designated places to the Great Plains. Great place to see dark skies, and they're just now starting to tap into that. So the more we start to protect the dark skies and designate these things, the more awareness is brought to light pollution.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for calling in. Congratulations on your new book. Especially thank you for getting up early and calling in from Hawaii. Marlon is a performer and author, and his new book is Astrotourism, Stargazers, Eclipse Chasers, and the Dark Sky Movement. Again, congratulations. John, before we go to calls coming in from the audience, I just have to ask you a very important question, which is, you're a photographer. What are your tips for people who, anybody who's tried to take a picture of a full moon knows that it's not really that easy. Give us a couple tips really quickly for getting great nighttime pictures.
Well, if you want, like, I shoot a lot of Milky Way shots and star and constellation shots. You really need a tripod because you need that camera to sit still. It's not like in the daytime where you have lots of light. You're dealing with low light situations, so you have long exposures. So you need your camera on a tripod. ideally you want some sort of remote trigger so you can press a button, or at least a timer so you press the button and step away so that all the vibration in the camera goes away. Because you're taking exposures that might be anywhere from 10 to 30 seconds long to get those stars to really show up. If you go much longer than 30 seconds, then the stars start turning into what look like little pills or little lines. And that's because the Earth is turning underneath our feet. Here in Maine, we're all headed to the east right now at about 750 miles an hour. And that makes the stars cross the sky just like the sun. And after, if you have a nice wide angle lens, after about 30 seconds, those stars start drawing little lines on your sensor or your film if you're using film. So cool. Tripod, okay. Wide angle lens.
Wide angle lens. Great. I'm going to start and with Peter calling from Camden. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think you have to go to the Great Plains. You know, you could just drive up I-95 between Lincoln and Medway and pull over anywhere you want, and you'll have the most panoramic night sky environment to enjoy. I would urge someone to approach those in the highway administration here to consider, you know, marking rest areas as night sky pullovers. You know, a lot of people drive long distance at night, you know, take a break, get out, take a look at the sky. But on a more serious note, the lines in the sky that the gentleman was just mentioning, one line in the sky now that's becoming somewhat controversial, and it has been actually for some time, is the Starlink constellation of 600 satellites. It now trails across the sky, and astronomers are concerned that, you know, over time, that constellation will grow and become a source of interference for especially radio astronomy and other things. The Chinese are talking about putting thousands of satellites up in this kind of constellation. But it's something that you want to take note of. My sister-in-law was mentioning it the other morning. She had been out walking her dog with a friend and had seen this arc in the sky. And she was asking me, because I'm a satellite type, what it might be. And I said, well, you're probably seeing the Starlink constellation with the sun, you know, just coming over the horizon. It's, you know, giving you a pretty good profile view of that constellation. It's something that's going to be in the sky for some time. It's something that people ought to be aware of.
Peter, thanks for bringing that up. And Sean, do you want to talk about that more? He refers to it as the Starlink satellite constellation.
Yeah, there's there's been several launches of these groups of satellites, basically. Excuse me. And where it used to be, you'd have a single satellite across the sky or moving. Now you have a row, and they've called them constellations, which sometimes people will confuse then with the constellations, the star constellations, if you will. But basically, it's a group of satellites that's moving in formation together. And they've launched these to hopefully provide internet service. That's one of the main reasons that they're there. But they are having an effect, as he mentioned. In fact, even the International Astronomical Union, sort of the governing body in astronomy, has been talking to these satellite manufacturers and discussing possible ways to try to reduce the impact on astronomical observations here from the Earth, because there is a concern that they could really impact research astronomy along with, folks who just enjoy viewing the dark night sky as well.
Peter, thanks for your call. An email here from Rachel. I've lived on the outskirts of Waterville and Augusta my whole life. I've noticed that within the past 10 years, the stars on the edges of those towns have been outshined by new parking lots, field lights, and store LED signs. Our local ice cream store has a huge LED sign that shines even in the late hours of their off-season. What will it take to get businesses, colleges, and towns to turn off unnecessary lights to preserve energy, brighten the stars, and now mitigate brown-tail moth travel? Susan.
Well, as I was mentioning earlier, there are some communities around the state who are looking at what they can do locally with their lighting ordinances to ensure that it's shielded, facing down, not facing up. I mean, the energy loss and the cost of this wasted energy is something like 35% of all outdoor lighting is wasted. And that's the equivalent of about $3 billion a year, just literally going up into the sky for no for no purpose.
Are there programs available to help communities with the planning and or the cost of changing lighting?
The International Dark Sky Association has a lot of resources on its website. There also are a number of states that are looking at legislation around capping the illumination levels of lights and requiring shielding, et cetera. And so I think there's a number of places that that people can look for assistance with that.
John.
Yeah, and one other thing there too is that, you know, right now there's been a motion to go to LED lighting. And LEDs, while wonderful because they use a lot less energy, typically they have a what's called a color temperature. And a lot of folks, you know, a lot of cities have went to really super bright ones, like, you know, 5,000 Kelvin, which is a really blue light, which it creates a lot of glare and actually is really bad for the night skies. There are some towns and cities who have regulated it, saying that they want them to only be, you know, 2400 to, you know, 2700 Kelvin, which is a much more softer, you know, yellow or oranger light, which doesn't affect the sky quite as much. And there is even some university campuses out west that have adopted that, because again, it preserves the skies in a better way in terms of making the sky visible. But as mentioned, there's lots of lighting ordinances. I lived out in Hawaii for a while as well, working with the Mauna Kea observatories. And you know, both Arizona and Hawaii have really strong lighting ordinances because they're trying to preserve the skies for the observatories they have. But it also needs to be done just for the general public's health too, because again, a lot of blue light at night in particular, that's why you're not supposed to be looking at your screens before you go to bed either. That blue light really can affect your circadian rhythms and your sleep patterns and things like that. So that's something that's really important for cities and campuses and places all over to really pay attention to.
And I know that there is awareness. Years and years ago, I did a story out at Pineland Farms where they had installed a bunch of lighting designed to be in tune with the dark sky movement. When in developers or people are renovating an area, is there an awareness that is there a place that they can turn to landscape architects, say, and architects to figure out the best lighting for that area? John?
Well, that's one reason we formed. We have an organization that's a year old, a nonprofit called Dark Sky Maine. And we're here basically as an educational resource for municipalities and the public and schools to learn about what makes good lighting and why the sky is valuable to protect that heritage that we value so much. Sometimes we take the sky for granted because we've always had it. And if you travel outside of Maine, you realize that most people don't have what we have and we need to protect it or else it'll go away. And the lighting is really important and the light temperature is really important. As Sean was saying, 5,000 K light, those bright blue white lights, that's the same basically as daylight. So if you have one outside your window and you're trying to sleep at night and it's shining in on your face, that's telling your brain it's daytime. So your brain has a hard time knowing it's time to go to sleep. It's like the CRTs when you're looking at your laptop at 11:30 at night and you know you should shut it off. It's that same type of light.
Brad calling from South Portland on the related topic, right?
Hi, Jennifer. Your speaker almost hit on what I was going to say. I'm a Mainer, but lived all around the country, 6 years in Tucson back in late 90s. And we had a really strong ordinance that suppressed the lighting and kind of changed the color. You got used to it. You know, it's just a little dimmer all around the city. And it's for the reason that at the University there, Arizona, they carve mirrors that go into the observatories. And they want, you know, that's a big investment to get down on top of a mountain. And they want to suppress the light and probably been doing it 30, 40 years. I was going to say, living around the country, one of the most spectacular times that I experienced this, South Padre Island between Corpus and the Mexican border. You park your car on the beach and let the night sky descend on you, and it's like a planetarium coming in your lap. Very stunning. I was also in Arizona when Hale Bopp went by. And that brought a lot of tourism. So I think the future remains probably bright on this topic.
Thanks, Brad, for calling. Susan.
Yeah, I just love to add, because I think this particular topic around, you know, it's kind of what can you do? And I think there's a lot that people can do themselves, both in terms of thinking about their own lighting and use of energy in their own residence or business. And then, of course, communities have a lot of control, as we've been talking about, municipal lighting ordinances. So talk to your local town officials. And if there isn't a lighting ordinance, you know, say, hey, there's some resources. Maybe we should think about this, because I think it's a great example of where individual action collectively could really make a huge difference in protecting the night sky in Maine. So I just would really encourage people to think about what they can do personally, but also what they can do within their community, and the kind of work that John and his group are doing to raise awareness. And AMC is just going to be really talking a lot about the significance of this now that we're officially designated. And you know, it's been a part of our education programs for about a decade. We're part of something called Mountains of Stars, where we've had astronomy programs at our facilities for a number of years, and school kids and all. So, but it's just, it's, I think there, as you've been saying, there's real momentum, and there's also a real place for individuals to take this on.
Well, Brad, thanks so much for your call. We do need to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation about dark skies, call us at 1-800-399-3566. If you hurry, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Naturopathic Health, committed to treating the underlying causes of chronic disease. naturopathicme.com, and Rooster Brother, the store for cooks and those who love them, at the Union River Bridge in downtown Ellsworth.
I'm Callum Borchers. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis will not commit to a statewide review of older condominium buildings like the one that collapsed in Surfside 2 weeks ago. Condominium law expert tells us what you need to know if you own a condo and you're concerned about its maintenance, and what to look for if you want to buy one. That's next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us for Here and Now. That begins today at noon on Maine Public Radio. Are you looking for something to do? Want to let people know about an event that your organization is sponsoring? Maine Public's Community Calendar is here to help. If you represent an organization and want to let listeners know about your event, be it virtual, outdoors, or otherwise, it's easy to enter the details on our online form, and it's easy to find things to do. You can search by type of event, date, or location. Maine Public's Community Calendar, bringing the people of Maine together with concerts, exhibits, workshops, and more. Visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and we are talking about dark skies, how and why to reduce light pollution, and where you might like to view the night sky. My guest, John Meter with the Northern Stars Planetarium and Dark Sky Maine. Sean Lotch, also with Dark Sky Maine and UMaine's Versant Power Astronomy Center. And Susan Arnold with the Appalachian Mountain Club. So many questions coming in. I'm going to go to one from Jean. She says, I am in my 70s and can no longer drive at night, especially on unfamiliar roads. I would like to experience the Milky Way in all its glory before I die. Is anyone in Maine running dark sky tours that provide transportation to stargazing sites for those of us who cannot drive or hike there?
I've not heard of anyone. I've not heard of anyone, any services that are existing yet for that. But my guess is that hopefully over the next few years, someone will start to do that, because it is one of those things. I do know that some folks, need that assistance. I'm not certain of anyone who currently does that.
It's a great idea.
It is a great idea, and I just would add that one thing we're very excited about at AMC with our designation is the 75,000 acres of land that we own. And we have three lodges on them. And one of those lodges is accessible four seasons of the year. You can drive up, and it's up in the northern part of the tract, and where you can actually, you know, get a view over some Roach Pond and then into Katahdin. So there's a very big, beautiful sky there. And so I would just encourage your caller to, you know, perhaps find a friend and they could go and stay for, you know, drive during the day, stay for a night and just walk out to the dock and look at that sky at night at a place like UMC. We're also looking to develop an observatory or observatory platform up on a hill not far from us. It will expand the potential for the view from our land. So we're, that access part though is so important. And I love that idea of a tour. I think that's just cool. Yeah.
John.
Yeah. I think the education part, because that's dear to my heart, because I've been teaching astronomy since 1979 here in the state of Maine. And I think that there are lots of resources. I do stuff with school kids, but like the Stars Over Katahdin event, which happens in Katahdin Woods and Waters every October, is open to the public. It's free. And I'm not sure, there's been talk about having a shuttle to go in and out because the roads are, you know, main backwoods roads. But there's star parties like that. There's the Acadia Night Sky Festival. Lots of people there, but beautiful skies. There's also a star party at Cobscook Bay every summer, the Maine State Star Party. I know for someone who can't drive, you've got to find someone who can get you to those places. But there are lots of astronomy people who just love to share what they know with people. And those parties are a good place to start that.
And John, I'm going to put information about those parties or have our team put information about those parties on our website. So please make sure you provide us with all that information so people can look on the website and find out about them. We're going to go to Steve calling from Frenchville. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
How are you?
Great.
Yes. I'm Steve Young. I'm president of the Upper St. John River Organization. We have a website, upperstjohnriver.org, and we're currently closing on our first conservation easement, and it's with Maine Natural Resources Conservation Program funds for wetland conservation of 120 acres. But this parcel, we already had renamed it an Acadian Forest Habitat Management Area, with the goals for which are for habitat, education, and recreation. And we put a dark sky up observatory on it 2 years ago. It's just an open building, but it's a fabulous location. It's a couple miles from electricity. It's got its own road, so like when the person just called in and had some mobility issues, you could actually drive right to the structure, you know, have a friend or a relation or someone right drive right to the structure. We're currently, we've brought a meter to read the arc seconds of light, I guess, from starlight, and in order to pursue official designation. But we're located up between Madawaska and Fort Kent. And the town of Frenchville, this is still going to be owned by the town of Frenchville. And there's a lot of other things we've got going on there. This is going to be a conservation easement where it's going to be a natural area. We have done some enhancement plantings. We're partnering with University of Maine at Fort Kent and the St. John Valley Technology Center on some interesting things like cedar planting trials, red oak acorn locally collected, and also milkweed for butterflies. And we're also trying to we're also partnering with the Rustic Birders. And somebody was mentioning liaison with STARS. Well, barred owl surveys is perfect for that.
That's right. Well, Steve, I really appreciate you calling. I'm going to try to get some more calls, but I'd love for you to go to our Facebook page, today's post, and put some more information about what you're doing up there in Frenchville and how people can get involved. So thank you so much for calling in today. Going to move on to Kevin calling from Buckfield. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for taking my call. I feel like among my people and among my friends with all these astro nerds and all these stargazers and whatnot. I will be very quick so you can get to some other folks as well too. Been hearing some comments about being an astro tourist and going to star parties. I think we should all think about being an astro resident and just turn your own property and your own home into an astro friendly and a night friendly place, and to host your own stargazing parties and gatherings with your neighbors, and to encourage your neighbors. We are all on social media and social network. Encourage your friends and family to do the same thing, and you'd be surprised how quickly the sky can get quite darker. And in Buckfield, I'm building a timber frame house and taking all of those things into consideration in the design of the house, making sure all the lights point down and this all of the just lights are night friendly and sky friendly. And so I just wanted to add that to you folks. And thank
well,
you so
yeah,
much,
Kevin, thank you so much for calling. I'm going to move on because I think our next caller is actually an expert in that kind of lighting. I'm going to turn to David in Scarborough. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hello, Jennifer. Thank you for having me on. I would like to, I'm a lighting consultant in Southern Maine, and I love this program because one of the, I think, attributes of it is something that isn't always recognized is that lighting design. And for me, when I'm dealing with clients, especially with landscape lighting projects, it's with real estate, it's about location, location, location. To me, it's about conversation, conversation, conversation. And that's one of the first conversations I have with landscape lighting, is respecting what lighting does and interfering with not also dark sky, but light trespass. And less to me is more, is my mantra with landscape lighting, and just being very hypersensitive to what we're using, not also for energy, but how we're using that. And you don't always need to have more to have an impact with lighting design, because I know it impacts not also your neighbors, but dark sky.
You know, David, I'll ask you this since we've got you on the call. I have a feeling our guests could answer this as well. But I think a lot of people associate lights at night with safety, for example, in parking lots and street lights, and maybe right. around their own homes. What do you say to people that say, oh, no, no, I need to install these lights because I want my home to be safe?
That's a great question. I think for me, I have to explain to clients that more light is not better, because it's, to me, it's what I explain to people is, if you're holding a flashlight at somebody, they can't see you, so they can't see behind you. So if you're just adding more light to your building, your structure, you're creating a curtain of light that people can hide behind. So more light is not always better. And that analogy of holding a flashlight on a friend and your friend to ask them what they can see, they can't see anything. So it's more about being strategic with the lighting. And for safety, again, you can provide adequate safety and roadway lighting, but shield it downward for the purpose it's intended for, and not wasting stray light going every which direction, because just because you see more light doesn't mean it's effective lighting.
David, thanks so much for your call. Tweet from Ava, she asked, oh, I should have kept him on, but I'll ask you all about this. What about solar garden lighting? Susan, has that got a big impact on night sky movement?
You know, that's an issue I don't know a whole lot about.
All right. Well, we'll move on. We'll go to Brian, who's calling from Waldoboro. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I happen to be the fortunate father of a young man named Ian Cheney, who is a documentary filmmaker. And I wanted to share with your audience that in 2011, he produced a documentary film, which basically was titled The City Dark, which is about, it scans all of the topics that you have addressed in this wonderful program. And it was nominated for a News and Journalism Award and Emmy Award, and then actually was broadcast on PBS on the Point of View stream. And so I just wanted to suggest that if people want to explore this more and hear some more information that he collected, they could just Google it and chase it
down. So the film is called The City Dark. Is it accessible online or streaming?
If Point of View has a streaming program the way Nova does, yes. I'm looking at the screen right now, and it looks like it does. It's a 52-minute film.
Great. Well, congratulations to your son, and thanks for calling in and letting us know about that. I want to go to an email here from Paul. Thank you to your guests for their work on this important conservation effort. The other benefit of these special places is audio. They are dark and quiet places. Susan, you're nodding. Sean, you're nodding as well.
Well, I was nodding just because thinking of something I mentioned earlier about the compatibility of bird watching and night skies. And thinking of the owls that you hear so often when I've been up at one of up the AMC lodges at night outside, not only the sky above, but this wonderful, wonderful audio of the owls. So yeah, makes really a good point.
We'll go to Alan calling from Winterport. Hi, Alan, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I was just, when I moved to my farm, I shut off the, switched off the pole light that was on an automatic mercury vapor lamp. And I wonder how many farmers have that because the power companies put them in and they're set on automatic and they just use them because they want to use more power. And then the other thing is all these municipal parking lots and parking garages and then schools and government buildings or corporate buildings that have lights on at night in the interior, maybe just to show off. Or I can understand custodial people need lights, but they should shut them off when they're done. What about the stray lighting from parking garages and parking lots that aren't used at night?
John, this is the educational efforts you all are launching, correct?
Yeah, I think.
Yes, it's about teaching people about.
Oh, John, ahead, you're Sean. Breaking up. I'll turn to Sean. Go ahead.
I say it's about. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing is we're trying to get people to understand that their lighting choices do make a difference. And, you know, even I tell folks, you know, and I had a conversation recently because there's a high school right next to where I live, John Baps, and they put up a new gymnasium. And I had the conversation with them ahead of time saying, you know, the light should be turned off and not left on all night long, you know, that, and they were very, very receptive to it, which was wonderful. But again, you know, just making sure that people are aware that you don't have to have that light 24/7. You can have it on a motion detector if you feel like you need that, but you can turn it off when it's not in use and you're saving energy, which is good for the environment and also good for the skies.
Sure. And motion detectors are so much less expensive than they used to be. Alan, thank you so much. I'll end with this email for Maureen. She writes, one of my most memorable backpacking experiences was coming upon a small pool of water at night. I gazed at it in wonder, trying to understand what the luminescence was gleaming in the pool. It became apparent after a few minutes that what I was seeing was the reflection of the stars. Beautiful. So thank you for that. And thank you to our guest today for this conversation, Susan Arnold, Vice President for Conservation with the Appalachian Mountain Club, Sean Lotch, Director of UMaine's Versant Power Astronomy Center, and John Meter, Director of the Northern Stars Planetarium and Educational Services. Today's sound engineer was Keje Akinmoladun. We had production help from John Keimel. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau, and today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.